This is Polling Matters, brought to you in association with politicalbetting.com. Today we're going to be talking about the Labour Party. We all know that the polls pointed to an election where there would be a hung parliament, a stalemate if you will, but in fact the Conservatives won a majority. So why did Labour do so badly and what happens next? Today we'll be hearing more from Lord Foulkes and from Professor John Curtis, who we spoke to last week around the sort of polling inquest part one. We'll be hearing more from them later today. And I'll also be joined by my fellow podcasters, Leo Barassi and Rob Vance. Guys, welcome back.
Hello.
Good to see him.
So I want to hear from Lord Foulkes in a moment, chaps. But first of all, I want to get your sort of top line views, really, on why it was you think that Labour lost. Who wants to go first?
Well, I think the seat results speak for themselves. Labour did extremely well in securing the vote in London, where it had a swing to Labour and picked up a number of seats. It squeezed the Liberal Democrat vote there very, very effectively, and in a few other places as well. It had a 35% strategy, which it got somewhat close to beating in terms of pulling the Liberal Democrat support in, but it didn't win votes over the Tories. It lost, I think, by some people's estimations, as many votes to UKIP as the Tories did, and the Tory vote strengthened in the kind of seats that it needed to win. In those marginal constituencies in the Trans-Pennine Corridor, in the market towns of the east of England and sort of central England around the West Midlands. And the Tories were able to mop up Lib Dem seat after Lib Dem seat in the southwest. I think the key thing there is you really have two electorates, one which is increasingly metropolitan, multi-ethnic and urban, which Labour is doing very well in. And then you have, in a sense, the rest of the country, where you've got UKIP squeezing what you might describe as a working class base in lots of different ways. And you've got a collapse of the Liberal vote, which has gone, I would say, disproportionately conservative in those seats. And we can discuss the reasons for that at some length. But if you look at the seats that Labour failed to pick up, Warwickshire North, Nuneaton, Ipswich, Carlisle, a number of places like that, there is a common thread to those, which is, being urban concentrations surrounded with a rural hinterland, places that are not particularly ethnically diverse, with some exceptions to that, obviously, but, with small businesses rather than big businesses, they don't have universities, the makeup of those places has a sort of common demographic, I would suggest, and I think it's in that specific sort of kind of place that Ed Miliband's message didn't get through. And that, I would say, is in a sense the coalition that the Conservatives have been able to put together of a swing, both in seats that Labour won in 2010, but also in ones that it lost narrowly. The Conservatives were able to win over those voters, and that's how they won.
I mean, Leah, this really was a spectacular win for the Conservatives, wasn't it? I mean, now the dust has settled, what's your impressions on the dynamics of Labour's defeat? I mean, we'll come on to the reasons for it shortly.
Yeah, well, one of the things that I think makes the defeat even worse than a spectacular defeat, whatever's next on the scale, is the detail of where Labour racked up votes and where it went backwards. That a lot of the successes were in seats that Labour was already doing quite well in, and some of those are the kind of places that Rob has touched on. But when you're looking at seats like Amber Valley, Hastings and Rye, Kingswood, my home constituency of the Vale of Glamorgan, these are places where Labour was within touching distance of taking them back from the Tories and went backwards in those. So even if you just look at the vote share and the number of seats, then you don't quite even then see how bad it was because of the challenge that Labour now is facing in the swing seats it needs to be winning. I think just the other thing to add to Rob's very good analysis there is the fundamental point that I think is going on in those seats is that it really seems to be a complete lack of confidence in Labour's competence to govern. And I think the polls that have come out afterwards, which I think we can hope sufficiently accurate for us to
might be better at diagnosis than prognosis.
Well, perhaps, and these are things we'll talk about today. But the challenge to Labour seems to be about convincing people about its competence much more than about the policy detail and the ideology.
One element we haven't mentioned yet is Scotland, and of course Scotland has always been a sort of Labour heartland, if you will. One seat remaining now, 40 lost. I'm going to play you a clip from an interview with Lord Faulks a couple of weeks ago, but actually all of the points remain valid, when we talked about Scotland. I started off asking him about how surprised he was by what happened, and let's see what Lord Faulks has to say, and then we can come back and sort of maybe talk about some of the issues.
I was devastated by the result. I'd expected the SNP to do well in Scotland, but they did much better than I expected. I'd predicted that we would hold about 10 or 12 seats, and of course we only held the one. And in England I was really disappointed, because there were seats like Carlisle and Plymouth Sutton and others that I expected that we would get. But clearly the polls had an effect by showing to people in England that the SNP were going to do well, and by the very clever move of the Tories to portray Miliband as being a puppet of the SNP with the strings pulled by Sturgeon or Salmon, they clearly alienated a lot of potential Labour voters, and they went to the Conservatives in England. So the SNP not only helped the Tories to win in England, as well as their landslide north of the border.
And obviously much attention is now going to turn to what the Labour Party does next, and obviously that's going to be something close to your heart, both in England and in Scotland. I mean, as a sort of experienced campaigner, do you have any views? You've seen the ups and downs of the Labour Party, obviously, in your career. Do you have any immediate views on the aftermath of defeat, or do you think it's just too early to really understand what happened?
I think the important thing is not to panic and realise that we've gone through these kind of things before, both in Scotland and in England. Not as bad in Scotland, but in 1974 the SNP had an upsurge. And in England we've seen the same kind of results previously. And it's important to take some time to work out both our policies and our leadership and to get both of them right. But in Scotland, and to deal with Scotland, I think one of the things we need to do is to have a comprehensive look at the whole constitution of the United Kingdom. Otherwise, the demand for separation will become louder and louder and inexorable, and we'll have to give in to it. But if we can come up with a federal solution or quasi-federal solution, which not only deals with the situation in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, but takes account of the English democratic deficit and provides some kind of stable solution, then I think the forces of separation will be held back. But we need to do that quickly.
And presumably, of course, just from a selfish Labour Party perspective, this campaigning tactic of the Conservatives to tie any Labour victory or success to being held in hock to the SNP isn't going to go away in 2020, if that is indeed when the next election is. Is it? I mean, the chances are if there is an election in 2019 or 2020, then the Tories will use exactly the same campaign tactic.
Yeah, we face that. We face the way in which the wedge was put in. And I understand that Lyndon Crosby deserves the credit for that, and the way in which it was repeated again and again and again by Cameron and everyone else. That will continue as long as the SNP are powerful. And in Scotland, if the SNP continue to do well in the Holyrood elections and continue to run Holyrood effectively, then we will have some problems. What we need to do in Scotland is to try and dispel the myth that the SNP is a radical progressive party. It hasn't been that. It quite the reverse. But they have been very clever at getting the message over and convincing people that they are radical. And they've also got a very good organisation, very clever people behind it. And we need to match that in Scotland as well as in the whole of the United Kingdom. So it's a big challenge ahead. And to do it by 2020 will not be easy.
So, guys, that was Lord Faulks. I think we'll all agree. Several good points raised there. Leo, what do you think? I mean, what struck me there was that Lord Faulks is bringing up this this point around the SNP not only taking seats off Labour, which we obviously know about in Scotland, and therefore that obviously has an impact on how many seats Labour have and their ability to form a government, but also actually the SNP were important in the impact that they had on the psychology of English voters, meaning that there was almost a double whammy, which meant that they're taking seats off them directly off Labour in Scotland and actually causing Labour to fail in England through fear of this kind of Labour-SNP coalition or deal or whatever it might have ended up being. I mean, what are your thoughts on that from some of the data, the limited data, I guess, that we've seen since the election?
Yeah, well, there's some evidence to support it. The new quite big poll by GQR for the trade unions looked at the reasons why people who didn't vote Labour say that they didn't. And a quarter of English voters say that they didn't vote Labour. One of the two reasons was because of the fear of the SNP. Now, if we assume that that is something that was completely created during the campaign, I think we can assume that 6 months before the election, very few people were thinking about the SNP's role with Labour, then that suggests that the campaign might well have had a major impact in creating that fear in people's minds about Labour.
But Rob, is there something else going on here as well? Because, I mean, one imagines that, you know, if it was Margaret Thatcher, not that it would have been, or Tony Blair, probably a better example, then maybe people aren't so worried about the SNP because they think that that leader can, like, take them on or keep them in check. Do you think that there's something going on here about not just fear of the SNP holding Labour sort of in hock, but actually the ability of the Labour leadership to deal with that?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, so I think there's a way of overreading even the results that Leo said, where there are certainly more important issues than the SNP. But I think there was a certain narrative which wasn't working as well for the Conservatives at the beginning of the campaign. There were lots of media stories about, oh, odd minute, maybe Ed Miliband isn't so bad. And his ratings started to improve. And they were never great, but they were certainly better, you know, a couple of weeks in. And the idea that the whole edifice was going to collapse within a couple of weeks of exposure to Ed Miliband and so on, it kind of didn't really take hold. But what did take hold was Sturgeon
in
doing
the polls.
Sorry? But, you know, what did come through, certainly in the media narrative, was an impressive performance by Sturgeon in the debates. A lot of media stories, egged on, of course, by the Conservatives, who were, I think, you know, I always talk about this, but, you know, ruthlessly consistent in their messaging in terms of there were two things that everybody knew about the Conservatives, you know, message in their campaign, and that's, you know, twice as much as most people were going to take out of it. So what it became is, I think, a proof point of Ed Miliband's perceived weakness with a bunch of people. So in the same way that in the debates, refusing to acknowledge any kind of responsibility for the deficit was a proof point of economic incompetence. So this isn't a policy point. This is a point about your competence to do something if you are elected as the Prime Minister. Similarly, people were faced with the prospect of an impressive leader who they disagreed with in lots of cases. I mean, even in some cases they agreed with, but an impressive leader who they felt might well run rings around Ed Miliband. And that was, in a sense, a more scary prospect and accentuated all of the negatives that people had about Ed Miliband in their eyes.
Because Leo, this issue of competence keeps coming up, doesn't it?
Yeah, and it's interesting, and I think it's perhaps a point that's picked up elsewhere in the data, that what Rob says about the SNP thing not just being something that played out directly as fear of the SNP, but also was seen to exemplify Labour's other weaknesses. That I said that a quarter of English voters said that the SNP was one of the reasons not to vote Labour. Well, 2 in 5, so 15 points more, said that Labour's perceived economic incompetence was one of their reasons to vote Labour. So, not to vote Labour. So, it was the SNP was still explicitly dwarfed by economic incompetence. But it's interesting that it's perhaps put into context by what else the SNP might have said in people's minds about Labour. I mean, just one other thing that does strike me about this, that we talk about how the SNP was created as an issue of the campaign and we see it as a big weakness. Now, OK, the polls got it wrong. We're clear that the polls got it wrong. But if the SNP was a bombshell that exploded over Labour's campaign and really hit them, you would still expect even wrong polls to show some effect. And Labour's score did not go down during the campaign. So, you know, maybe the polls were wrong in multiple different ways and they didn't pick up this change. But it's interesting that we're assuming that the SNP was something that really, really damaged Labour. But I'm still yet to be completely convinced from the polls that it was there.
And I suppose that's one of the problems with the polling inquest is that we're never really going to get a definitive answer on that. Let's hear a bit from John Curtis. So we spoke to him a little bit about Scotland, but also about the UK more widely and this issue of competence. So I'd be interested to get your guys' thoughts on what he has to say.
Certainly, I very strongly take the view that if you think that the answer to the Labour Party's problems is simply to try to appeal to the so-called aspirational voter in England, you are seriously misguided. Because once you start looking at the electoral arithmetic, actually, if the Labour Party doesn't recover the losses in Scotland, it will need something like a 12-point lead at the next election in order to get an overall majority. You cannot win. The Labour Party cannot get back to power simply by trying to appeal to voters in England. It has to reclaim the ground lost in Scotland. And we already know from the existing polling evidence that the people the Labour Party have lost in Scotland, A, are on the left, and B, they're voting for the SNP because they regard them as more left-wing, more egalitarian than Labour. So you've got, and so therefore, in Scotland at least, the idea of aspiration, tacking to the right, sounding more business friendly is completely the wrong prescription. Okay, but there is a common problem. And the common problem is that Ed Miliband, I mean, I've already said, Scottish Labour Party, no clear roadmap for the kind of Scotland it wants to create. Ed Miliband, no clear roadmap for the kind of Britain he wanted to create. His leadership, in part, was just littered with the wreckage of failed attempts to come up with a phrase that encapsulated what he was about. Predators and producers, responsible capitalism, one nation labour. They all bit the dust. And there wasn't a Labour slogan in the election. There wasn't something for people to grab onto. And there certainly wasn't any sense of enthusiasm for the prospect of a Labour government that we think could actually run the country. They had never succeeded in persuading people that they'd learnt the lessons of the financial crash. And you saw it particularly, you know, one obvious dramatic moment that kind of underlined that was the audience reaction when Miliband said, no, we didn't spend too much money, which I think, you know, most people think is just plain wrong and certainly foolish line to take, given he was willing to admit a whole load of other mistakes the Labour Party had made in this period. So what is required is a vision. It's a vision that will appeal of the kind of country you want to create. And where I think there's plenty of room, because Cameron's not very good at it either, is to create a vision of the kind of country you want to create, which in a sense, above all, can bind people together, both who are from the left in Scotland and who maybe are slightly more centre-right in England, but around which there's a sense of enthusiasm, not least because you've addressed the competence question. Right? And until the Labour Party persuades people it's capable of providing competent government, it doesn't matter what ideological stance it takes, people are not going to vote for it.
Okay, so a few different points there. I guess one of them is around this issue of Scotland and voters there being more to the left or voters elsewhere in the country. And I guess that, if true, provides a very difficult challenge for the next Labour leader, doesn't it? Because ultimately they're going to have to come back. they're going to have to combine votes in Scotland from quite left-wing people, but also more centrist, to use that phrase, people in the rest of the country. We've also got this issue of vision and the spending of money and the economic competence. And then I guess also this issue, more broadly speaking, of you can't do anything unless you're proven to be a competent government. Let's start with the Scottish element of this. Do we agree with John Curtis there that ultimately, you know, the problem, ultimately that, you know, just appealing to aspirational people in England isn't going to be enough? Who wants to go?
So I'm not sure quite how to say this as delicately as possible, but I think there's a strong argument for the Labour Party just forgetting about Scotland. I mean, I think there's a danger, certainly at this point, of when thinking about what the Labour Party should be thinking about for 2015, of rerunning the 2010 general election. And I think there's at least three big things that are going to have shifted in that time. And we shouldn't forget that the Tories aren't going to stand still either. So they have control of an agenda and have the ability to shift stuff around. But I think specifically on Scotland, I think I do take issue with Curtis's argument that Scotland, that the SNP won because they were able to position themselves as to the left left of Labour. I think he himself has said previously that there are all sorts of other issues involved in that, one of them being competence and them having made a pretty good fist of 8 years in or 9 years, whatever it is, in Holyrood.
But his point there, just to interject briefly, his point there is that, you know, if you have a pro-business kind of, for want of a better phrase, Blairite agenda from Westminster, that is not going to win back people in Scotland. Do you think that's wrong?
Well, Tony Blair wasn't bad at winning in Scotland.
Yeah, I think, and
the context is different, though, isn't it?
Of course, but the context is everything. And I think the reality is demonstrating competence when you're in opposition is really, really hard. But also, I mean, I would make a sort of macro point, which is to Lord Foulkes' point earlier, which is the constitutional settlement in which the 2015 election is going to be fought could well be radically different. I mean, never mind whether there's going to be another referendum and Scotland could have gone altogether by then anyway, which I think is unlikely for all sorts of reasons that perhaps aren't relevant to this episode. But I think that the reality is that whatever constitutional settlement the Conservatives come up with, it is going to be really difficult for there to be a Labour Prime Minister who doesn't have some way of forming at least a coalition of votes in a majority of them in England, or at least England and Wales for certain purposes, you know, depending on what kind of they end up with. So I think for two reasons, one being I disagree to a great extent with the idea that the SNP outflank Labour to the left, the Labour Party needs to appeal purely to left-wing voters in Scotland. I think it needs to demonstrate competence, it needs to demonstrate that it's listened, I think it needs to demonstrate that it's able to negotiate with the Tories, I think it needs to run councils effectively, I think it needs to hold the SNP to account, I think it needs to do all sorts of things, almost none of which require a particular policy stance.
Abandoning Trident
that
or something,
you might have. You know. I think this is it. I mean, like, it's all very well to say you need to appeal to left-wing voters in Scotland. What does that really mean? And in some ways, the Tories might well help them in this anyway, on the basis that if they choose to go for full fiscal autonomy, which, let's face it, the SNP don't want because it would be a £7 billion hole in their budget. All those kind of things, you know, the Tories could make Labour's, in a sense, challenge north of the border relatively more or less difficult. But I think in terms of the analysis of Scotland being to the left, don't necessarily agree with, and I think in terms of winning in England, I think it could well be at best irrelevant to sort of the argument.
Yeah, the key difficulty in the argument that you can only win in Scotland from the left isn't only about whether or not Scotland is really more left-wing than England, for which I think the evidence is mixed at best, but also about this key question that we're assuming that votes in Scotland, as in anywhere at the moment, are principally based on policy salience, that people are looking at the collection of policies and saying, this is closer to my view. If that were the case, of course, it would be an utter nightmare for Labour to do well in left-wing Scotland.
And isn't it standing up for Scotland? Isn't this where the SNP is?
Yeah, competency to negotiate the best, you know, fiscal dividend, right?
Exactly. I mean,
is it there, or is it that actually people think that when I'm sending MPs to Westminster to look after my interests, people in Scotland, maybe as a result of the referendum, see politics in Britain as a almost like through the prism of the nation of Scotland, and therefore who better to stand up for the interests of the nation of Scotland than the SNP?
But I don't think it's even necessarily purely a sort of nationalist thing, ironically enough. I think people looked at, and this isn't meant to just sort of, you know, piss all over Ed Miliband, but I think people were like, who do we want representing us? Labour did very, very well in 2010 because Scots looked at Gordon Brown and went, he's one of us, he's always done well by Scotland, and they, you know, they won, if not more seats, then certainly more votes in Scotland in 2010 than in 2005. I think they looked this time and went, who do we want standing up for the interests of Scotland or for Dumfries or for Glasgow or wherever it is? And went, do we think Ed Miliband's going to deliver on that? Do we want Ed Miliband to be Prime Minister of the UK? No. I'm not saying it was a referendum on Miliband, but I think it's a relatively easy choice for voters to go, actually, you know, the SNP led by Sturgeon and, you know, looks like it's going to get a good deal for Scotland.
We cynically jumped in on Leo's point. I'm sorry about that, Leo.
That's right.
Carry on.
I'm used to it.
No, I mean, the SNP at the moment are a formidable machine for exactly the reasons that Rob's talking about, that they are supremely well positioned for making the case that they can stand up for the interests of Scotland better than anyone else. And I think it was actually Professor Curtis on a previous pod here who talked about 45% losing your referendum but hugely winning your election. And what they've done is bring together all the people who are principally looking for people who will stand up for Scotland. And that is going to be very difficult to take on at the moment. And essentially, I strongly suggest that policy is irrelevant in an ability to gain
supporters, it is probably not irrelevant in ability to continue to lose them, because the challenge for Labour is demonstrating competence, in this case competence to stand up for Scotland, and that in a policy sense almost certainly means, from opposition, demonstrating policies that show a Labour government is one that is competent to stand up for Scotland.
Well, maybe it's not standing up for Scotland, because that sounds like a passive oppositional thing. Maybe it's about delivering for Scotland. Yeah. Then maybe the argument is going to be some way along the line, they can stand up for you all you want, but we can actually deliver for you.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I guess it's like...
They can argue for the purse, but we can actually control the purse.
They can clap in the House of Commons, we can pass laws.
But they'll presumably... Maybe, I mean, it's one of my arguments with this whole thing, is that both with the SNP and the Tories, Labour's situation is not only about itself. I mean, it's a bit like snooker. Like, if the other person's at the table, until they miss, you're not getting on the table to score points. And maybe it's not a perfect metaphor, but actually the Tories have to lose their competence as much as Labour have to gain theirs. And with the SNP, I think that there needs to be a period of the SNP being seen to not actually deliver these things they say they're going to before Labour can swoop in, if you like. Let's talk about the competence thing.
And I don't think the Conservatives need to mess up, just to be clear. I don't think the Conservatives need... You don't need an ERM-style challenge to their competence. The point is... In all of politics is about choices. And so, already we're seeing that the Conservatives are having to make choices. They've got a relatively small majority. There are divisions within them that arguably are much more pronounced than any divisions that are going on in Labour. They're perhaps not as audible. The referendum is going to be a real challenge. You're going to have a third of Tory MPs, possibly as many as that, maybe even more, who end up backing an out campaign with their Prime Minister, leader, Chancellor, most of the Cabinet staying in a yes vote. You've then got the way in which the Conservatives need to navigate the Scottish question. Do you do full fiscal autonomy, which arguably it leads to an inexorable path to a referendum, maybe not in 5 years' time, but certainly in the future, on the basis that the SNP are essentially operating Trotskyite tactics of transitional demands, which become ever harder to fulfil, and demonstrate the fragility and impossibility of the union as each time they make them. And then you've got a series of other cleavages within the Conservative Party. The point here is that competence is partly not messing up your own issues. I mean, bear in mind that the things which demonstrated Labour competence in the 90s were not just about... They certainly weren't policy positions. They weren't just about the ERM. They were defeating the government on the social chapter in Maastricht, of exposing all of those cleavages. There were obviously the things about Tory sleaze, but there was also things like Robin Cook's mastery of the Scott Inquiry report. Yeah. Which, if anybody has the time to read, the accounts in any account of that is incredible. But, there are things which are not about left or right policy positions. They are about sheer competency to government. I mean, even tough on crime, tough on the causes crime is like a beautiful sort of syllogism of being able to sum up a sort of apolitical point that people can kind of nod along and go, yeah, that kind of makes sense, I think my point is...
Yeah, sorry, competence is, to an extent, it's written by the winners, isn't it? That the government, it makes some mistakes, and what matters is what the opposition does about them. Had in the time between 2010 and 2015, the opposition absolutely destroyed the government on the failure of its initial economic plan and its need to revert to Plan B and its so on and the other economic choices that it made, some of which went badly wrong, then we would right now be looking back at our government and say it was their incompetence that lost them the election. Mm-hmm. But because they didn't, we say, well, they were quite a competent government. They did quite well.
Yeah. I mean, let's think about the leadership candidates. It seems like there's two broad themes of which Scotland keeps rearing its head, but there's themes around competence and vision. And, I mean, I was at the Progress hustings a couple of weekends ago.
For your sins.
For my sins. I'm one of those people that goes along to these things. I don't think the candidates were particularly ignorant to these facts. I mean, each one of them, for all that the media wants to pigeonhole candidates into the Blairite, Brownite, Union, whatever candidate, and those may be valid. I'll leave that to other people to judge. I think they all seem to make the point that actually economic competence is important. We need a vision for the country, etc. I mean, I don't want either of you to endorse a candidate necessarily, unless you feel you want to. But I mean, what's your early impressions of the field at the moment? Within that prism, do you think there's one that gets it more than the other? Or do you think that, I mean, one of the things I think that it certainly looks right now in the early days that each of the candidates has very strong points, but each of them also has drawbacks too.
So, One of the things that I really took from that GQR poll that I mentioned earlier is that the policy positions Labour went into the last election with were, on paper, hugely popular. You can't look at that poll and think anything other than Labour had policies that, if you put them in front of people, tested well. The challenge was, as we keep on talking about, competence. So
when credibility to deliver them.
Yes,
right.
Precisely. When it comes to the leaders, it seems to me that any candidate who can't demonstrate to the electorate that Labour is not just tweaking its policies here and there, it's not just sort of fiddling a bit around the edges, but can show that Labour has changed utterly and has hugely learned the lessons. If the candidate can't break through the belief that Labour's hugely incompetent policies, hugely popular policies, they were not competent to deliver, there's an enormous problem. And so, to get to my point in terms of the candidates, it seems to me that the candidate for whom this is the biggest problem, who is in the race, is Andy Burnham. Mm. Because I could well imagine, I think it's almost established now, this early in the race, that were he to be elected, the response by the overwhelming majority of the media will be Labour is still in its comfort zone. It has elected a reassuring leader who was part of previous government and is not going to change stuff. Mm. And that might be hugely unfair to him, but I think it is his enormous problem.
I'll come to Rob. I mean, isn't the problem, Rob, that actually, I mean, the economic competence point, I think, speaks to this, is that it's almost not necessarily that important what the truth is, because I guess in many respects the truth is subjective here. So isn't Leo right in the sense that, you know, for example, with the economy, like, no one really thinks, well, it's not really that credible that Labour caused a financial crisis, but at the same time, there feels like the public wants some kind of apology from Labour of some kind for the economy. Likewise with Andy Burnham, it feels like, from what Leo's saying, almost regardless of what happens, he's almost managed to have himself branded as the union candidate and the continuity candidate anyway, regardless of what he says. What do you say to that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think, so that first of all, on the competence point, I mean, I think Labour has forgotten the lesson that it should have learned from the Tory collapse in the 90s, which is Labour supported going into the exchange rate mechanism. You know, if Labour had been in power in 1992 when the whole thing fell apart, then, you know, Labour were signed up fully to what was the biggest policy debacle of the entire decade, and then reaped arguably, you know, a decade's worth of political success out of it. I think the fact that we've failed to acknowledge that fact in 2010 is a real challenge, and I think that's always going to be a sort of political reality that whoever's in the driving seat, as it were, when these things happen, is always going to be left with egg on their face, to not mix too many horrible metaphors. Sorry, what was your original question?
You can't mix a metaphor without breaking an omelette. Breaking an egg. What was my original point? Well, Leo was talking about Andy Burnham being sort of almost fatally wounded before he goes into the battle.
Yeah. So
can't be 100% true.
Yeah, but I suppose my overarching point would be, I think it's I personally think it was a bad call, though potentially an economically sound one, as it were, on the part of the party's finances to make it a long campaign. I think there's a bit of a challenge in terms of seeing the future of the Labour Party purely through the lens of this leadership contest and deputy leadership contest. I would view the sort of like supposed policy differences between the candidates with a considerable degree of salt. And also, I would hope that this isn't going to be the only means through which these policy differences and challenges can come through. You don't see a huge amount of new ideas. I think that a lot of new ideas are going to be necessary to come through over the course of the next parliament, 4 or 5 years, is whatever it might be. And to that extent, I mean, I kind of agree with Leo to the extent that Andy Burnham does have certain credibility issues. He was Chief Secretary of the Treasury. But let's also bear in mind, he was a fairly Blairite, not an ultra, like a sort of, you know, Milburn or Byers character, but he was a fairly, you know, of that ilk, shall we say, during his time as a government minister and cabinet minister. He has, I think, probably quite astutely recognised that there is a sort of an opening for him to sort of take what might be described as the left position, but I'm not convinced that he's particularly credible as a kind of, even as a Miliband, Ed Miliband Mark II kind of character. He might be deploying a similar strategy in terms of, to some extent, greater or lesser.
Win the contest that's in front of you, basically.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You can only win the contest that's in front of you. I'm always a bit wary of judging, you know, someone's competence by the campaign they run, but it's certainly the way in which American presidential candidates are, in a sense, vetted. And there's an extent to which, like, if you can win the campaign convincingly, maybe it's easier for Burnham, like a US primary, to, you know, win from what might be perceived as the left and then tax more centrally, than for, you know, a candidate that's going to, as it were, cause more ructions. But again, I think...
Didn't we see 5 years ago
Ed failed to do that.
How easily a candidate is labelled by how they win their campaign.
Well, I agree. But then I think there are things that you can do, and there are ways that you can insulate your own and inoculate yourself from that. And whilst I'm very keen on the sort of competence thing, there are... It only takes a few bold policy, you know, announcements to I think change the media narrative and draw lines under it, and arguably, don't know whether this is necessarily true for winning the leadership campaign, but arguably from a sort of grand political perspective, maybe it's better to make those bold, as it were, bold sort of line drawing things, rather than in the midst of the leadership campaign, to do it in your acceptance speech and in the conference speech that you're going to make to the Labour Party thereafter and to the nation.
But Ed Miliband tried to do that, didn't he? I mean, we look back, the interesting thing about Ed Miliband is that, you know, everyone's dumping on at him as the loser, I suppose, and that's politics, that's to be expected. But
yeah, it's not personal. You know, I mean, there was a crowd of people around him, he should have been...
No, but the economy, you know, that was on the front page of the manifesto. He wasn't ignorant to that fact. There was no new borrowing. Yeah. Immigration, he said that they got it wrong.
Yeah.
You know, the trade union link is probably much more broken now than it ever was under Tony Blair. So there is something around perception here, isn't there, Leo? Because
though lots of those things were quite late. So
is this about nailing the colours to your mast?
Well, but perhaps some of it. I think the economy stuff, it really felt like the kind of things Labour were saying in the campaign were things that I'm sure there were hugely protracted discussions in the leadership about how to do this, but there were lots of things that were said that people hadn't heard but could have done with hearing several years earlier. So perhaps I'm sort of arguing myself slightly out of the corner of saying that Andy Burnham's huge problem is how he's labelled in the campaign. But there is one other point that I feel really superficial in saying this, but unfortunately I think it is important that Labour is going to struggle to get people's attention at the moment because most voters don't take it seriously. And there's not an election going on, so people aren't going to notice it unless it does something that really grabs their attention. And yeah, that's sort of sad, but it's true.
Well, any political space is going to be referendum and London mayor and...
Absolutely.
Know, and Scottish elections.
Andy Burnham looks quite like Ed Miliband. They're both dark-haired, reasonably... darkish skinned men. I think there is, I mean, this it sounds utterly trivial, but I think there are going to be voters who are barely going to notice that Labour's changed their leader unless Labour elect a woman, and that is going to be a thing that in itself is going to get people's attention.
And I guess another aspect to this, let's come back to that in a moment. Another aspect of this, I suppose, is the shadow chancellor, whoever that turns out to be, because one thing we're ignoring is Ed Balls has gone now. And if we talk about economic competence, surely a very quick way of that being established or not is going to be in whoever it is that's selected to be the shadow chancellor, be that Rachel Reeves, I guess would be one of the front runners. Maybe I'm wrong, but or it could be somebody else. Let's talk about...
Chucker. I mean, let's face it. I mean, you know, if, for the sake of argument, you know, you can imagine Chucker has just endorsed Liz Kendall. If Liz Kendall were to win, which I think is, you know, probably a higher probability than lots of people are giving it at the moment, then you can imagine Chucker being quite an interesting and dynamic, you know, person in the chance, you know, in that office, pro-business focus, good track record on, you know, that thing. People understand those ties. Media like him. There's a very quick way in which you can imagine a shifting narrative on that.
But let's as we sort of come to a close. I mean, I don't know what the correct phrase here is, but the woman issue. There's three candidates for Labour leader, a female, one male. How damaging is it for Labour if they elect a male? Yeah, I mean, do you think this matters? I mean, Labour's never had a female leader.
I mean, I think Leo's point about just the saliency of what it would mean to elect the first female Labour leader is probably less ridiculous than it sounds, without wanting to sound mean to Leo.
He's usually quite ridiculous. So.
It's the best compliment I've had from you, Rob.
Well, that's right. I mean, I'm always loath to sort of dwell on these kind of things for I think the same reasons that Leo is. It's not as interesting a media narrative, you know. I suppose the media narrative would then be that they've gone for the first Cambridge graduate in, you know, three generations or something.
That's the Rob Vance narrative. I don't think that's the media narrative. But actually, that raises an interesting point. There were murmurings of people saying they quite liked Nicola Sturgeon during the election, weren't there, and how. I think she topped one of the debate polls in a UK-wide debate poll when she was only the SNP were only running in Scotland.
Well, so look at Borgen. You know, women running progressive parties is electorally really successful, right?
And you've got Hillary Clinton running for president in America.
But
so
I think
maybe
you've also got to think about how it exposes the Tory leaders that Cameron, I think, is quite obviously going to struggle against a woman in terms of his tone.
Well, he's not running, right?
I'll come to that. But over the next couple of years, I think he would. Really, some of his sort of the bully boy side of him, I think would be really exposed. You're right. Of course he's not running, and you know we can't see Labour electing a leader on the basis of who the Tory leader might be in 5 years.
I don't know. It's done crazier things than think about what's going to happen.
For example,
in 5 years
I could well imagine that both Osborne and Boris Johnson could well look quite bad up against a woman. Whereas, for example, Theresa May, it puts them in a slightly different position. But if we say it is more likely than not that the Tories would elect George Osborne or Boris Johnson,
7-1
between them, then it seems to me that a female Labour leader is probably going to have an advantage in terms of perceptions of the Tories as bullying and out of touch.
And isn't this, I mean, to close, isn't this the final point? I'll give you both a sort of 30 seconds or so on this. We talked a lot in quite negative terms, I think, actually, about the Labour Party's potential, just because of how difficult it is to win this competence thing back, and the lack of vision maybe that's been there in the past, and also the problems in Scotland and elsewhere. I think we started this podcast episode with a sense of the scale of defeat being very difficult. But surely the easiest way to win these competence arguments is that the Tories are going to lose one of their biggest assets in David Cameron, aren't they, before the next election, assuming that he stands up to his end of the bargain. Rob, last sort of 30 seconds from you, and then I'll give Leo the close.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think a lot's been written, and Curtis pointed there about, you know, needing a 12-point swing to take back the seats if you don't include Scotland and so on. But I think, having talked a lot about how, you know, there isn't uniform swing across the country, I'm kind of more optimistic than maybe, you know, necessarily give credit for. There's a sort of tipping point, I think, which is, you know, similar arguments are likely to be effective in similar bits of the country. I think there are going to be lots and lots of challenges to this sort of, you know, decade of Conservative hegemony that we're sort of like reading about at the moment in the papers. We've talked about some of them already. The European referendum is going to be massively divisive. What happens to UKIP after that, whether it's a win or a lose, I expect it's a lose for UKIP. But, you know, what that means for the vote in all sorts of places, the changing dynamics of the country, which will be younger, more ethnically diverse, arguably more metropolitan. You know, these sort of dynamics are really, really important. Whether the Tories can get through boundary reform, whether the Conservatives make some of the arguments easier for the Labour Party in terms of reforming the trade union laws, reforming the way that the House of Parliament works with regards to Scotland and so on. There's going to be a hugely shifted terrain, and I think whilst I think it's an uphill struggle for Labour to remain unified and to appear competent, I think the idea that they need to come up with some magical rabbit out of a hat that is able to be a left-wing bunny in Scotland and a right-wing bunny in Nuneaton is, you know, I think they're sort of over-egging sort of the challenge somewhat, right? If you look at where the Conservative Party was in 2005, having lost its third general election in a row, and then, you know, you saw what they were able to do, first of all in 2010 and then in 2015. I think all of these things...
With a bigger Labour majority, obviously.
Much bigger Labour majority, then I think, you know, the challenge, you know, is somewhat shifted.
I think, Leo, with bunnies and eggs, I think Rob's missing Easter by the sounds of it. But last word for you.
Yeah, look, he's right. There's a lot... it's a challenging position for Labour. But there's going to be lots that's going to be shifting around over the next few years. One other thing we haven't talked about today is UKIP and what happens to them. And clearly, given what we've seen about where lots of Labour's votes have gone, is an enormous difference between a UKIP in 2020 that is strong and united and one that has gone the same way as the BNP.
Mm-hmm.
So that is partly out of Labour's control, though of course not entirely. I think Rob again. I think I agree with what you're saying about the sort of not looking for the magic rabbit bullet.
It's a quantum bunny. That's what it is. It's a quantum bunny. There's different in Scotland.
Magic rabbit bullet.
So look. This is I think. It's not a policy position that is left wing in Scotland and right wing in the South. That, as you say, clearly doesn't exist. But nonetheless, Labour is, with all these things that we're talking about, it's going to struggle to get voters' attention over the next few years. And you're right, there isn't a
policy. So maybe a quantum bunny would be useful for
This is sort of my point, that there isn't a policy position that is going to win people over. But nonetheless, I think Labour does still need to do quite a lot, quite loudly, to get people's attention, because otherwise it ain't going to cut through.
But not stunts, right? I mean, I think that was the challenge of this campaign. I mean, I think, you know, the stunts is not the way to do it. I think defining what you are about, as I think all of our commentators have said today, but also what you're not. I mean, I think this is a Tim Allen point. But Blair was very, very good at this in terms of saying what he wasn't. And that's not just about dividing lines, that's about saying what it is that you don't stand for, rather than being something for everybody.
That was Polling Matters in association with Political Betting. A very big thank you to Leo Barassi and Rob Vance as ever, and also to Lord Fawkes and John Curtis for their contributions as well. In the coming weeks, we're going to be speaking to a number of different people, revisiting the sort of polling inquest as a result of what happened in this election, and also the Liberal Democrats too. So do keep an eye out on Political Betting, but also on the link that we'll post on Twitter for more episodes of Polling Matters. And thanks for listening. The music you're about to hear is Pollinate by Kirk Pearson, licensed under a Creative Commons. Thanks for listening.